All right, welcome to class today. Before we dive in, are there questions, comments, concerns, or other things for me? Yes?
I have a question on the CY, I have a question on the difference between a color space and a color modeling.
Okay. We will come to that as part of what we do today, so I will write it down so that we do.
And,
yes?
And another one. Like the reading said, like on the CMYK color model set, on the reading said that, like, compared to RGB, which adds like component colors, CMYK displays like monitors use dithering and halftoning.
Mm-hmm.
And but it didn't make sense to me because I was like, wouldn't there be like a loss of quality in the CMYK image since it requires you to increase or decrease the size of the dots just to express like a shade? And like you need more pixel density to accurately describe the image.
All right, we'll talk about that too. Yeah.
What was the first line drawing algorithm that you talked about last class, and not the one before you?
All of the other. Which one?
The one where you pick the dimension with less distance, and then you do like one per row.
Yeah, so that is called either the DDA or the Bresenham. We'll talk more about those in class on Thursday. Yes?
Would you post a quiz due date on the calendar?
Oh. Yeah, I think I can. It might require a little bit of hack in the back end.
All right.
They will always be noon of Tuesday. But I will see. All right, so due date. Except, of course, the warm-up quiz, which was different, so I guess I set you up for failure there. Other questions? All right. Yeah, so the quiz, I think the showing you the mean isn't currently hooked up right. I know if anyone looked at the results, I suspect you saw the mean of zero on everything. That is not true, as you would have witnessed when you got at least one right? And failed to contribute to the mean. So I failed to get one of my scripts working there. I will add that back in. Sorry, it should eventually show you distributions and means and so on. But I don't have that hooked up. But I'll get that hooked up fairly quickly. So let's dive in. So today's topic we have is color. And lots of odds and ends to read there, one of which in particular, the Wikipedia article on color, is quite long. I will try to highlight what I thought was interesting about this, and we'll also talk about some of those other odds and ends as we go along. To start with, though, we're going to talk about the fact that you have eyes. Because, you know, I realize that not everybody really understands that they have eyes. I mean, I think they all know they do, but I don't think they all know what they do. All right, so what do you have in your eye? You have the most important things, the most important things you have in your eye, for our purposes, are a pupil with some muscles to change its shape. We won't talk a lot about that, and a retina. So the basic process by which we see things. Let's just start here. Not that this is hugely important for graphics, it'll be a little important when we talk about lens blur and the like, or depth of field. But the basic idea is when you are looking at some point on an object, if you only got light that came from that point straight into your retina at some particular location, you wouldn't get very much light. Because light going in one particular direction off an object is so vanishingly small, you wouldn't nearly see it. But fortunately, you have a lens. And the purpose of your lens is to take all of the light that came from that point and hit your lens and redirect it in the same place. And it actually does this sort of upside down from what I just drew. It happens that the way optics work, it will focus it all right back there. Okay? And that gives you enough photons that you can notice it. And so then, where it hits your retina, you need to be able to sense that it happened. Your retina consists of, for our purposes, four important components. You have three kinds of cones and one thing we call a rod. And this is because of the way the nerves look, and that's so not important for this class, okay? But each of these has a different set of wavelengths it responds to, okay? And mostly, we won't deal with the rods. We'll come back to why we won't deal with the rods. Mostly, we just deal with the three cones. They are the ones that matter during the day. And we'll talk about why. But each of the cones has certain wavelengths of light that if the photon of those wavelengths hit them, they send a little signal back down to your brain that says, I saw something. And so this is how we see. Now, let's talk about what those cones are. There are various versions of this graph. It's hard to get it exactly right. But we have three basic kinds of cones. We have the blue, the green, and the red. Also sometimes called the short, medium, and long wavelength. Light, in case you have forgotten, is measured in wavelengths in nanometers. The visible spectrum is from around 400 to around 700 nanometers of light per wavelength. That's what we can see easily. And the cones do not equally respond to light. So the blue cones barely respond at all, making blue look dark. The green cones respond quite a lot. The red's a fair amount. You'll also notice there's quite a bit of overlap in what wavelengths of light they will respond to. So if we were to shoot a 500 nanometer wavelength light into the eye, it has some smallish chance of interacting with a blue or a red cone, and a much larger chance of interacting with a green cone. And so we would see that as being mostly green. There'd be a little bit of blue, there'd be a little bit of red, but mostly we would see green. And these are the cones we have. They are the only cones we have that are, the only sensors we have that are active during the day. There appears to be some variation in exactly how these are positioned in different people's eyes, exactly where these peaks are. You may see a little bit more or less than other people, but they tend to be fairly stable in where their receptivity is based. And from this, we get all of color. So understanding how we get all of color is an important, and what causes color is an important part of understanding how color works in computers. So, given this model, one of the things we could ask is, what color do we see with an X nanometer light? Okay? Each individual photon has one and only one nanometer wavelength, and so we just have a line. We have a line of colors, or a curve of colors, or so on. And one of the ways that we usually view this, we usually show it in some little shape sort of like this, that you may have seen on one of the WP articles. Let me go down to an example of this picture. Here is an example of this picture. And this is a picture that's trying to answer that question. From just under 400 nanometers up to around 700 nanometers, the outer curve is as close as this projector can approximate the colors you would see with pure single wavelength light. And everything on the inside and across this line here, all of that is only seen by mixing wavelengths of light. It is actually true, and this is, there's a lot of people that do this. You don't actually see any purple down here. And we'll talk a little about why that sometimes shows up and sometimes doesn't. Anyway, this usually just looks like a deeper blue than you're used to seeing, which is a little bit weird to most people. But for any given photon, it just shows up along this outer curve. Okay? But we want to be able to display the whole gamut, all of the possible colors on the computer. And we don't have mechanisms that are affordable and small enough to put in screens that we can say, I want to shoot a 487 nanometer light. Okay? We can't pick arbitrary wavelengths. So in order to do this, the way computers typically do this, let me see if I can get an overlay here working, is we're just going to pick a few points in this space. And we're going to emit just those wavelengths and then use linear combinations to get everything in between. So for example, we might decide to pick that point, I don't know, maybe that point and that point. We'll figure out things that can make, I should put them all the way on the edge, these exact wavelengths of light. Okay? And then by varying the intensities of them, we can get everything inside that triangle. Let me erase the wrong points there. All right, so we find something that emits a single wavelength of light, and then by mixing and matching, we can get a triangle of illumination. There are colors we can't get for any set we pick, because this is a curve. Okay? So any finite set of basic emitters will miss some colors. However, you have all grown up in the days of computers, and your eyes have been trained to see these colors and these colors only. So this is a rough approximation. Of course, you can see this color, but the reason you can see this color is it's coming over a projector, which is trying to simulate the colors by using different colors, and is actually, right, like the real, oh, I don't know how we'll do this. Let's do it out here, right? So arguably the actual like base points they have are something like this, and so this is only showing you a subset of the colors because it's a computer monitor, but this is the concept, is we pick a subset of those and we display everything in between. And we pick three because this is triangular-ish. And that's good enough. We don't typically pick 520, even though it's up at the edge, because it turns out that people don't have a lot of, they don't really care about the difference between green and blue nearly as much as the difference between green and red. So much so that you probably heard that yellow, which is sort of halfway in between, is a primary color, but you probably never heard that cyan was. Right? And we'll talk some more about why that is here in a moment. But these spectrum is very important, because this looks like one kind of food, this looks like another kind of food, and that looks like danger. Right? And so we're biologically designed to care about those. But this doesn't look like much of anything in the real world. The sky, maybe a tiny bit, but it doesn't really matter. Like, and some flowers, it just isn't an important color. Okay, biologically. And so our brain as designed, actually physiologically designed, you have many more green and red cones than you have blue cones in your eye, probably. The exact ratio of cones varies a little bit, which contributes to color blindness. But you have different numbers of cones, you have a lot of green, a fairly large amount of red, only a few blue, probably. And your brain just doesn't think a lot about blue. There are various cultures that we know of that have words for red, greens, and blue, and yellows, but no words for blue. So it just isn't important to people, naturally. But it makes cool colors, and so we use it a lot today because we can make any color we want. Okay. So, that is my basic conversation about colors. We'll certainly talk a lot more about what they mean in practice, but any questions about the eye, the physical reception of color? Yes?
Can you use more than three colors to get like a better response?
Yes, you can.
Why don't people do that?
Because the extra thing you get is not big enough.
Okay.
Right, it's a cost-benefit analysis, right? If we add one more phosphor here, if I add one more phosphor there, like, does any of these colors matter? Yeah. Right? We have more blue-greens. Hooray! Right? That's part of it. The other part is that down at the edges here, if we back up to this view, right, out here, it doesn't. We have to put so many photons to be seen because all of the cones barely react. That wouldn't be particularly effective. And that sort of boundary that you can see differently than the main photons is sort of right in here, where you again have fairly low receptivity. So it just isn't economical to do that. Other questions? I should actually comment. It isn't economical to do that on a camera, on a projector or a screen. Paint does. And we'll talk a little bit about how paint is different because, you know, the natural world. Yes?
So like a butterfly, for instance, they can see like they have like six different color cones or something like that.
Yeah, some of them do.
Can they like not discern like what we can discern on a TV or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. So not all creatures have the same things we have. Let's, for example, look at the classic example, the mantis shrimp. Oh, I spelled it wrong, but it'll probably still work. Now, mantis shrimps are extremely colorful and basically extremely violent creatures. They wander around and hit people with their claws. All right, but if we look at their eyes, we get this nice little picture. Oh, yeah, okay. I've seen this exact version before. All right, this is an effort to say, here's what humans can see, and here's what mantis shrimp can see. Okay? And when we first just measured the receptivity of mantis shrimp cones, we thought, they must see this amazing world. And so then people said, well, if that's the case, we should be able to make them act like they see an amazing world. We should be able to put them in the basic way we measure things about animals, right? Do something and then shock them, or do something and then feed them, and help see if they can figure it out. And they are really bad at telling apart colors. They have almost no, like, it doesn't really matter what wavelength you give, it's just like light, and they'll like keep getting shocked over and over and over again, even though you're like, I only shock you on red, and I don't shock you on ultraviolet, and they, like, yeah. So who knows what they actually experience? They should be able to experience quite a lot, but they can't, as far as we can tell. Some of you, chances are in this room, maybe one or two of you, actually have four kinds of cones. Approximately 10% of females and 0% of males have a fourth cone. And I have not seen any study that suggests that four-cone females can actually discern any pair of colors that other people can't. Not a single one. So we don't know why not. It's probably enculturation, right? Most of you probably don't have words for even most of the colors we have right now. And when you don't have words for it, you don't think about it, it becomes hard for you to tell it apart. So by far the thing that matters more in telling apart colors than what your cones are like is how much you've spent time talking about color. And so if you're used to thinking about, you know, a dusty rose, it's just a hint of periwinkle undertone, then you're better at thinking about colors than if you don't, or whatever it happens to be. Other questions? All right. So this is the basics, the physiology of eyes. Now, I mentioned we have a fourth thing called a rod. The rod has a similar overall spectral sensitivity. It's sort of like the green cones, but a little bit wider. But we never actually care. And to understand why we never actually care... Oh, too much. All right, to understand why we never actually care, let's talk a little bit about how the eye sees light and how brightness matters as the other piece of the eye before we get into computers and paints. All right, so... If you think about one individual little conical cell here that reacts to light sitting on your retina, okay, and some light bumps into it, okay, in order for it to do something and send a signal down here, because biology, something has to change. It has to go from a state that is ready to say, I saw something, to a state that says, I've sort of spent that energy. And on average, this again varies somewhat based on individual and diet and how energetic you are and lots of things, but it takes about 1/12 of a second for it to reset. Okay? And so if photons are coming in too fast, your eye just sort of is screaming, I see everything, to your brain at all times. And you can't tell the difference between dark and light. It's only when there's a reasonable gap, right? So I'm going to, essentially, each cone is going to send a signal that varies between 12 hertz, if it's completely saturated with light, and really, really, really slow if it's not, right? So 0 hertz if it's not. And this difference is how much we see bright. So this will look bright. If I get a full 12 hertz signal, that suggests that at all moments, light is touching. If I'm down at 0, it suggests I never see light. And in between, I get sensitivity to different kinds of lights. Again, these numbers are approximate, right? But anyway, this is the basic concept. Yes?
Is this where the, like, human eye can't see over 30 frames per second thing comes from?
Yeah, but that's also false. So we'll talk about that in a moment. Okay, and we'll talk about why it's false. Anyway, all right. So we have this coming in at some rate. And if there's too much light, I can't make out any information. If there's too little light, I can't make out any information either. Because if I get down, say, to the 1 hertz space or the half hertz space, if I get way down there, then I'm getting a photon, and then a photon, and then a photon, and the space between them is large enough, my brain can't put them all into a picture. So I need them to come fairly frequently, but not too frequently, and that means I need the right amount of light. And this is why our pupils dilate, okay? Our pupils dilate to sort of change the size of the window that lets in light, to try to keep the light in an appropriate range. However, rods are way better at noticing light than our cones and way slower at resetting. So if there's enough light for the cones to give us a meaningful signal, the rods are just saying light all the time and we're not learning anything. So your rods only really come into play in really dim scenarios. Okay? In the dim scenarios, they pick up the light that what the cones would miss. They pick up the light much more often and we're able to see somewhat in the dark, but basically only one color. And it's sort of a greenish color, but a bit broader. Okay? But you don't know it's a greenish color because you never have a chance to compare it to your other colors. Because if you can see with your rods, your cones are basically inactive. They're seeing so little light, they're never firing. On the other hand, if your cones are active, then your rods are just sitting there saying light all the time, and so we don't really ever see with them both at once. We also have relatively few rods, and they're mostly around our peripheral vision. Basically because we want a lot of cones in the middle. We just have space on the retina to shove rods into the valuable cone space. You can't easily do things in the dark because of that. We basically ignore rods in computer graphics. It's such a weird scenario where somebody's in the dark and you're trying to make images in their peripheral vision, right? It's not a use case that comes up enough to be worth programming. So we basically just deal with the cones. Okay, dealing with the cones. So let's talk about how we do it. Do we want to get to this now? Let's pause one step first. All right. Let's actually back up to this. All right, we've got blue, green, and red cones. And if we fire something way out here in the 700 nanometer range, you see red, solid red. And way down here in the 450 nanometer range, you see blue. And in the middle, you see green. Okay? So how do I make other colors? And the rule is, again, sort of from, from this picture here. Okay? These other colors are made by a combination. So in particular, if we take a lot of red, so if we get our red cones high, and we get our green cones sort of middle, then we see orange. And that's just how it works. This is what the color does. Why does it see orange? Well, why do we call it orange? We have to see something, and that's what we call it. Okay? And this is counterintuitive to many people, because if the red is high and the green is high, we see yellow. Okay? And we can keep mixing and matching colors. Many people say, this doesn't make sense. And a lot of they're not making sense is because you learned about colors the wrong way. Let me explain what I mean by the wrong way. You learned about colors in the context of pigment. Let's talk about how pigment works. Let's imagine I have something white. And I have, let's actually change my background color here. There we are. All right. So I have something white. Let's actually make it white. So I have something white down here. And I have white light coming in. Now, what is white light? White light is really light of every wavelength. So white light has some red light in it, and it has some green light in it, and it has some blue light in it, and other wavelengths. All of the wavelengths are coming in, okay, from the light source. And in a white surface, all of those wavelengths will bounce back off. So all of those wavelengths will come in, they will all bounce off, I will see the white color, the white created by every kind of light. But if I were to put over top of this a green film, okay, maybe by using a crayon or paint or something like this. I put something green and transparent over the top. What do I mean by green? I mean by green that the green photons either bounce off of it or make it through and come to me. Okay? I see the green, but I don't see the other things. So that means that in particular, my blue get absorbed and turned into heat. And my red get absorbed and turned into heat. And so only the greens survive. That's what green means in pigment. Okay? Most pigments are transparent, so most of them actually do the bounce through to the white thing underneath, which is why you can't easily use crayons on black paper, right? But a few of them are opaque and do the other model instead. So tip, because they're transparent, I could layer them. I could put on top of the green film a red film. Now if I put a red film on top of the green film, this picture changes. The red photons make it through the red film but get absorbed by the green film. The blue photons get absorbed by the red film and the green photons get absorbed by the red film and I will see black. No light coming out. Okay? And this is not your experience. And the reason it is not your experience is because we don't actually use primary colors in the light sense for painting. What do we use instead? So let's see what this actually looks like. We have white surface. And the primary colors you were taught when you were a little child were?
Red, green,
no.
Yellow.
Red, yellow, and blue. And they were wrong. They mislabeled them. The primary colors are actually yellow. They got that one right. And then a color that looks sort of like red but isn't, magenta. And cyan. I think I have a cyan here somewhere, but I don't remember the keyboard shortcut for it. Ah, no, I don't seem to have a cyan. Come on, where is cyan? It's got to be here somewhere. Is that it? That's green. Ah, no, I don't have cyan. Curses. I thought I set this up with cyan. All right. Cyan is a bluish color, but not blue. Sorry, I should fix that. All right. Yellow is the pigment that absorbs only one of the three primary colors of light. It lets red and green through. So a yellow pigment, if I put a yellow pigment over top and I send in my blue light is absorbed. But my red light passes right on through. And so does my green light. And therefore I see red and green, which together make yellow. I'm only absorbing one type of light. And because I'm only absorbing one type of light, if I were to put on top of that a magenta, here we are, if I were to put on top of that a magenta film, magenta lets through blue and red, but not green. And so the green wouldn't make it through the magenta, the blue wouldn't make it through the yellow, and I would see red. And if I were to use cyan, magenta, and yellow together, I can create, mix and match different colors. And if I put it on a little bit, then it only absorbs some of the wavelengths, and some of the light, and some of it will make it through. And so I can mix and match these and make almost any color. Now, it turns out that magenta in particular is a hard color to create. And so traditional pigments made sort of a reddish magenta and used it fairly lightly, and so we called it red. And anyway, it took a while for us to find something that was really truly magenta in the natural world, which is how you have to make pigments. But if we think about it from the context of this diagram here, the goal of a pigment is essentially to block a small number of wavelengths of light. You want to just block a little bit, or a medium-sized piece that you can mix and match different pigments to block the set of wavelengths you want to block. And so if you have something that only lets through red light, it blocks everything else and will look almost black. Okay, and you won't be able to mix and match it. So pigments tend to block small regions of light and let everything else through, whereas phosphors and things we use on computer screens tend to emit small wavelengths of light and leave everything else off. And because our eyes only select via three cones, both of them will end up giving us similar concepts to what we can see. Thoughts, comments, questions about these ideas? Okay. All of which leads us to color solids, color models. You have three cones. So we can describe colors with three variables. And the simplest of those is red, green, blue, because that describes your cones. So let me see. Oh, that was way too big. All right. So if I go down to the red, green, blue model, okay, this is a more or less biological model. How much is the color at hand going to trigger your red cones, your green, your red cones, your blue cones, and your green cones? If it triggers them all, white. What is the color on the back corner of this cube? Black. None of them are being triggered, okay? This is an easy one to think about. This is often the default in computing, because we have to tell the screen how much to turn on the blue phosphor, or the blue TFT, or whatever it is that's emitting color. And so we need to eventually give this number to our screen. And so this is a sensible model for computers. But it isn't necessarily a good model for artists. We'll come back to that in a moment. If we are printing, no, where did my CMYK go? Ah, maybe I don't have that solid. I don't have that solid. Okay. If I am printing, I want just the opposite of this. And actually, I can draw it on the same box. Okay? So if I were to take this same thing and I were to say, well, this direction, the opposite of the red direction is the cyan direction. The opposite of the blue direction is the yellow direction, and the opposite of the green direction is the magenta direction. Okay? And so the red, green, blue model and the cyan, magenta, yellow model are just inverses of each other. Equally easy to compute with. I just take one minus for each of the numbers, and ta-da, I'm there. All right? So these two models are easy to use. We typically use the CMY if we're printing, and the RGB if we're doing something on a screen. But swapping between them is fairly easy. Now, it turns out that making pigments that are really, truly cyan, magenta, and yellow is complicated, and so we usually add in a black, because if you mix those three pigments, you get sort of a muddy, grayish color, and we like black. So we usually add a fourth one for pigments, and that combination is a little bit messy, but not too bad to compute. But those are not great for thinking at like an artist. And as computer graphics, we make things for artists. So artists usually like to think, well, let's talk actually first about this cube here, because it may be the easiest one to see how artists like to think. We like to think about rainbows. What are the colors? Hey, now this is not what rainbows look like. Rainbows don't have this section right here. Rainbows go red, yellow, green, blue, stop. Because those are pure hues. And that's what rainbows do, is they create pure hues. But if we just sort of wrap it around, then we get the magenta and purple in there as well. Hey. But if we decide that's one of our axes, what can the other axes be? Well, another thing we like to talk about is how bright a color is. So we'll put black on one side. And we'll call that value. A higher value reflects more light, a lower value reflects less light. And then what's the remaining thing is how grayed out is it? And we call that saturation. But this isn't the only way of doing this. Hue and saturation are natural things to have. But value didn't need to be value. We have black down here, but we have white along this edge. That's asymmetric. Okay? And asymmetry bothers people. Wouldn't it be nice if we had white on the top? But if you have white on the top and black on the bottom, then where would we have all the other colors, right? So there's lots of ways of trying to say, oh, well, let's use lightness instead. Let's put white on the top and black on the bottom. And then we have this like band of the rainbow halfway up. That's ugly. Maybe we can't do cubes at all. Let's try a cylinder. That's better, but we still have it around the middle. If we're going to go in the middle, I don't know, maybe we can put it back on the top, but now we have white as like this point in the middle. No, not great there either. We can make it a sphere. Spheres are nice. Now the outside makes sense. We're just taking the same numbers and reworking them, okay? Notably though, we have a new word here that I have just sort of glossed over. When we switch to having white on the top, We call the black to white lightness. We call the black to bright value. Okay? So if you value colors, then more value will give you brighter colors. But if you value light, then more lightness will give you more light, right? So if you value colors, you'll get more colors with more value. But if you're just getting lighter, it'll just get lighter. That's my rough mnemonic, right? So anyway, there's lots of these color solids. Some people say, no, this is not linear if you make it a sphere, but we really want it to come to a point. So we'll make it a cone, and then some people say, no, squash that cone. Anyway, right, lots of ways of thinking about it. The main thing to take away from this is none of them are the right one. None of them are clearly the best. And because none of them are clearly the best, we as computer scientists have to convert for artists that have their favorite. Okay? So some artists will want to think in this color space. And if you force them in a different color space, they will be upset. So we have to magically turn this color space into this one because this is the one computers can use. Okay? And sometimes we will have to measure individual photons to create things like rainbows. We'll talk about that here in a moment. But this is the basic idea. The color solids are pictures. The color models are which three of the, how many total variables do we have on this page?
Four.
More than four.
Seven.
More than seven.
Ten.
I have labeled 10. I have hue, saturation, lightness, and value from the artist models. Red, green, blue, cyan, magenta, and yellow from the programmer's models. Okay? And arguably, you could take any three of those, with a few exceptions like things that are the opposite of the other things, and you could describe everything with them. But these are the ones we most commonly use. It's usually either hue and saturation plus either value or lightness, or it's red, green, blue, or CMY, okay? And so we have to convert between those two, and it's not obvious how to do it, and a lot of ways of trying to do it end up looking quite bad. We'll see some of that as you play around with color models for homework three. Yes?
On the chromaticity diagram, what are the X and Y axes?
Yeah, so that's a good question. What are these X and Y axes? They are just other axes. That sounds horrible, right? The goal of the chromaticity diagram and the way they picked X and Y, and there should be a Z here too, right? Because we need three dimensions. What dimension is missing from this? Notice I have pure hues and white. And so if I have a surface of pure hues and white, that would be like the top of the HSV, so value is the one that's missing. Or maybe I'm sliced through the middle of an HSL, and so maybe I'm missing lightness, right? But I'm missing one of those two, okay? So I've got a missing axis, but why this shape? The goal of this shape was to try to get a projection of the pure hues in a way that humans thought was approximately visual distance. It was experimentally created by SIE, which I used to remember what this means. There's a whole lot of CIE, the International Commission on Illumination. That's why I can't remember, because it's not an English acronym. I shouldn't be so upset. Anyway, so the International Commission on Illumination has met many times over the past 100 years trying to come up with a reasonable model for color. And they have changed their mind many times. There are many, many CIE color spaces, all of which have the goal of saying, if you have in this projection of colors into a dimension, we should be able to say Euclidean distance is similar to perceptive distance. Yes?
Is that like distance from the eye? Or?
No. Distance from the eye doesn't change color.
Yeah, so distance.
Meaning, all right, let's see if we can make this clearer here. What do I mean by perceptive distance? Which is more similar, red and orange or red and blue? Okay, and if you ask a lot of these questions, you say, which of the, show three colors and say, which one is this one most like? You can come up with a human perceptive, intuitive distance metric. And it's a little different for everybody, so you do this for hundreds of people with thousands of color swatches until everybody is completely mind-numbing in the experiment. And then you say, okay, now we have a distance metric, can we embed it in space? Because we need to represent it with numbers, and numbers imply distance. And so it'd be nice if we had something like that. So the in particular, the CIE models, and there's many of them, they basically try to map the hues as linearly as they can, and then they make the other distance perceptive brightness, or luminosity, which is somewhat different than either. It's closer to lightness than it is to value, but somewhat different from both because green looks brighter than blue. And anyway, it gets a little messy. We could easily spend 2 weeks just on colors. We could probably spend a semester just on colors. We're not going to, okay? We're going to sort of end that at some point today. Other questions about any of these topics so far? All right, let's talk about why using just, well, actually, let's talk about how we use these in computers most of the time. All right, so most of the time we want to represent a color we represent with three numbers. You should have, many of you have already seen this with homework zero, okay? We say we want some amount of red, green, and blue, and we just give them numbers in some space. Because we care about speed and low-level performances, the most common space is 0 to 255, which is really ugly. Why 255? The largest single byte value. Hey, this is horrible. We shouldn't have ever done this. We should never have pretended we were doing this. The much better numbers are 0 to 1, as dark as we can get to as bright as we can get. And most of the time, this is what we want to think 255 represents 1. And if we multiply colors, we want to multiply them in this space, not this space, and so on. Okay? And that will become more clear when we talk about transparency and so on later. We typically represent things as three numbers. Now, if you start fiddling with the numbers, you will discover weird things. Changing this number a little changes the perceptive color a whole lot more than changing this color a little. Because your eye is about 10 times more sensitive to green than to blue. And so you can make fairly big changes to the blue and the color just sort of ekes a little bit away. And you like change green by 5, you're like, oh no, that's too much, right? Anyway, it's really weird to play with. So this is not the ideal color model, but this is usually what we do. We store things as just three numbers. Three numbers are great for many purposes, but they fail. And to explain why they fail, I'm going to make them fail here in the classroom, which means I'm going to have to turn off all of the lights and use lasers. All right, so let me turn off all of the lights and use lasers. Oh, right, all of the lights. Let's see, is there a way I can blank this? Yes, I can. I can do this. All right. Still a tiny bit of light, but it'll work for our purposes. Oh no, now I lost the diffraction grating. Here we are. All right, so here I have a laser. Hey, there is a spot. I have in my hand here, what you can hardly see, is a tiny little rectangle. And as I spin it around, you may notice there's a couple of other little dots. Do you see the other little dots off to the side? Maybe it'll be easier if I go up closer. Little dots off to the side. Okay, this is because I'm holding something called a diffraction grating that causes different wavelengths of light to turn differently. So if I grab this device, turn this one on, and I shoot a green laser through it, I also see two different dots. Okay, same basic effect. Hooray. Now, if I am magical, I'm going to be able to use both of my, no, I'm not. This worked so well in my office, but I don't remember how. All right, I want to shine the red laser through it, and, nope. No! I don't have enough hands. Does somebody want to be a third hand for me? Here, hold the diffraction grating for me. All right. So I'm going to shine a green laser and a blue laser through it at the same time from the same distance. And what do you notice about the position? Oh, well, that's not the same angle. Let me see if I can get them to line up. Very hard to do. All right, so I'm trying to line up this. I don't have a big enough diffraction grating. No. All right, maybe I'll do one underneath the other. That might work. All right, so, no, my experiment is failing. And the poor people listening to the recording have no idea what I'm talking about. All right, but if you notice, the distance between the green dots is smaller than the distance between the red dots. Okay? That's because of how light works. Thank you. Sorry. We'll do some more experiments in a moment. Let me turn back on some lights. Okay. So what's happening? First off, I have a diffraction grating. What is a diffraction grating? It is evidence that quantum mechanics is true. So what happens in a diffraction grating is it has a whole lot of very, very small, microscopically small slits. If we look at it in the plain light, it just looks like a transparent window. But it really has these microscopic little metallic threads in it, spaced perfectly evenly apart. Okay? And as light comes in, it comes like a wave, and it bumps into those grids. And it bumps into those grids, we get constructive and destructive interference. The whole exploratory about this is a little bit complicated. Let's just talk about the two-slit version, okay? If I have a wave propagating through, it sort of resets here and resets there, and where the two lines intersect, it looks bright, and where they don't, it doesn't. Anyway, this is not a physics class. I'm not going to go into huge amounts of detail. But the spacing of these openings and the spacing between wavelengths of light dictate how far apart those overlapping or not overlapping waves are. Okay? So if I have wider space things here, they'll be closer together. If I have narrower space, they'll be farther apart. If I have longer wavelengths of light, similar phenomena. But this wavelength of light, that's what we call color. That is those, 400 nanometer things we were just looking at. Okay? And in particular, I believe I signed a 540 nanometer and a 680 nanometer laser at it, if I remember what my lasers are correctly. So this is what we call red. And this is what we call green. And so the green one had a shorter wavelength of light, didn't spread out as much, because from its perspective, the slits are farther apart compared to its wavelength. So it didn't spread out as much. So the two green dots on the board, the big green dot and the little green dot on either side, were closer together than the big red dot and the little red dots. Okay? This happens anytime we bend light. It doesn't require diffraction gratings. The main other way we bend light is with water. So I have here some water. Let's explore what happens if we pull a sphere out of the water. All right, so here I have a sphere of water. Okay, and I'm going to shine my laser. Oh, okay, we're going to need to turn off lights again. All right, so I shine my laser through the sphere, and it just gets a little bigger, okay? That's all I initially see. But if I can pull it off to the side enough, no, I don't think it's gonna be bright enough. If you look over in the corner of the room, you see another little bobble. That is not caused by diffraction, that's caused by bouncing off the inside of the sphere. Ah, no, it's so hard to do this. All right. So I have, when light hits water, a sphere of water usually only appears in the sky because most people don't have, ways of holding spheres of water. Anyway, let's put that back with its native water. All right. So when we have things like a sphere of water, okay, and light comes in, it bends as it enters the water and bends as it comes out, and that's great. It gets a little bit fuzzy in my laser, right? But some of that light will come in, it will bend, it will bounce off of the inside and come back out. And these ones will differ in what angle they come out based on the wavelength of light. So the red will come in and red moves farther, so it will bend more. And it will bounce out at one angle. And the blue on the other extreme, although blue is hard to see on my screen, let's use a green instead. Okay, so the green coming in exactly the same trajectory doesn't bend as much. And therefore it bounces off at a different angle. And so we can spread out light. And this creates rainbows. Okay? Rainbows are just lots of little spheres of water in the air in just the right place so that the sun comes in, bounces off the back, and we are standing here in the side looking at the rainbow having spread out the light. You can't simulate rainbows if you're storing everything using three numbers. Because there's just three numbers. You won't end up with a rainbow, you'll end up with a strip of red, a strip of green, and a strip of blue with nothing in between. So occasionally we actually care about how light really works. Other examples of how we care about light really works, this used to show up a lot, but basically nobody has it anymore. Do any of you have any CDs? Oh yeah, okay. Have you ever looked at a CD? What do you see when you look at a CD?
Rainbow.
Music. No, right, yes. You see rainbows. You see rainbows, actually, literally for diffraction grating reasons. CDs have little circular grooves all the way around. They're metallic instead of transparent, like a diffraction grating. But the light goes in, bounces off different wavelengths at different angles. You see a rainbow. CDs are hard to draw. Another example we will see is an oil slick. Okay, oil slicks occur when you have water and then you have oil. Now, oil doesn't get very thick. Oil is okay being very, very thin. And what happens is, as the light comes in, some of it bounces off of the oil and some of it bounces off of the water. And they're close enough together, it acts like a diffraction grating. And you get rainbescent effects. You can get this on feathers, because feathers have lots of little parallel barbs. So some birds will sort of glisten in these ways. There's lots of things in the real world where each individual wavelength bounces a little bit different. And you will notice, if you pay attention, these almost never show up in CG movies. Okay? And every once in a while they do, but they're faked. Because they want to show off, we can do bubbles. So they will make a sphere and they will just sort of like paint a rainbowish thing across it. Okay. Anyway, it is possible to do this, but to do this you have to measure every wavelength, and that's messy. And it takes a lot of work to do that compared to just measuring three basic colors or a single light that you change the color of. Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions so far? All right, let's now talk about, so that deals with four of our five links for today, but doesn't talk about gamma. Gamma is messy. All right, let's explain why we care about gamma. Gamma is not a natural perceptive phenomena. It is almost purely a we need to show you pictures and technology is bad phenomena. Okay? Although it sort of comes out of photography as well. All right, let's suppose I say, let's describe it this way. Let's suppose I have two black pixels, okay, and let's give ourselves a grayish background, and I have two white pixels in this position, okay? And then I also have somewhere else, I want to have four pixels that are all gray, which conveniently is my background color right now, so I don't have to draw it. Okay? Which of these two arrangements should emit more photons? Okay, this seems meh, right? Let's suppose in particular that this is supposed to be 1, 1, 1. And this is 0, 0, 0, is our colors in RGB space, and these are one-halves. Okay? Then intuitively, in this case, I would want to see the same amount of photons from both. But I very rarely do. Okay? There's lots of reasons why I very rarely do, but a lot of it actually has to do way back to when we were talking about how lights react to things. Okay? Remember how I talked about what our light measures is sort of the hertz, how long it takes for me to see the next photon? Okay? We never really reach as fast as we can, because that means there'd be 0 seconds between one photon and the next touching. So we just sort of asymptotically approach it. Okay? And so if we were going to try to do a number of photons versus the hertz are our particular cone sees, at zero, we see zero. Our eyes are very good at that. Actually, this is slightly false. Sometimes our cones fire for no reason. That's a side note. It's so rare, we can basically ignore that. All right. And then let's suppose the maximum we can do is 12. We are not going to just go like this. Nature almost never has corners. Okay? Instead, we are going to see this sort of exponential approach. But we're never actually quite going to reach it. We're going to asymptotically approach, but never reach as fast as the eye can respond. And because of this, the importance of the difference between, let's suppose that I want to measure, you know, if I say this is as bright as it gets, this is 1.0, this is 0.5, well, that looks almost like 1.0. The difference between two bright colors is less interesting than the difference between two dark colors. And when we're dealing in 256 space, we often don't want to waste space. We don't want half of our stuff for things that all look the same. But this curve depends on the ambient light. This is part of the reason we turn off the lights in movie theaters. If I turn off all of the light, I know the screen is the brightest thing you are looking at. And so I know that your pupils are going to change until the bright things are close to the top. But if there's something brighter next to what you're looking at, then it won't work that way, and your curve will move. Okay? So we cannot control with a screen alone, unless we can control the rest of the environment, what your actual receptivity to different colors are. Your brain sort of averages this out and so on. But in practice, what this means is that we tend to have gamma. And to understand gamma, here I have, all right, so we can see what I actually have here. Let me zoom way in. Okay, here is my picture. I have white pixel, black pixel, white pixel, black pixel. I have green pixel, black pixel, blue pixel, black pixel, red pixel, right? Okay, in a grid. And then I also have gray. Okay, and I have grayish red, right? Dark red, and so on. I will zoom out so I have a one-to-one pixel mapping. This is a measure of the gamma of my screen. And it looks like we have a pretty good gamma on this particular projector. Can you see the squares in the middle of the squares?
Yes.
The gray one.
If you're trying this on your computer at home, if you watch this video, you probably will be able to see them much more clearly. Depends exactly on what your screen is like and so on. Okay? It's easier when I slide it around. You have this weird artifacts anyway. But I can also, because, let's see if I could do this. All right, so let's go back here. All right, so I'm going to run the x gamma function, and I'm going to set my gamma. No! Do I not have xgamma installed? Well, that's awkward. All right. I'm going to install gamma. Let's see if this works. Oh, right. Don't worry. I am root. No, wrong password. All right. We'll do it the log way. Sorry. I thought I had prepared for this, but I did it on a different computer. All right. Yes. Yart xgamma. Ah, that's what it's called. Great. Yeah, let's proceed with the installation. All right. Now I should be able to run what I tried the first time. So let's set the gamma correction. All right, so I have just told it. We're still not seeing it. Okay. I don't know why this is not working. Maybe my monitor is overcorrecting the gamma. Oh, that's easier to... maybe not. Yeah, a little bit better. Okay, and so I can change the gamma correction. Wow, it is dramatically different on my computer and on the screen. Ah, now I can't see anything at all. All right, I'm gonna just x gamma g1. All right, there we are. All right, what is this doing? Okay, so this projector has a pretty good gamma response. What is a gamma response? It's just the ratio of brightness of a black-white pair to a gray, to a 50% gray. How bright are these compared to each other? And so we can, if we wanted to, Another way of saying this, if I say 0 and 255, I measure the amount of light that comes out of the pixel. Okay? If this is a straight line, we call that a gamma of 1. As it curves away from that, we call this a gamma greater than 1, or on the other hand, a gamma less than 1. Now, the numbers on the two sides are meh, because we use gamma for two ways. We could use the number of my screen. I could say my screen makes middle value pixels brighter. Or I could say my screen needs to correct middle value pixels to be darker. Okay? And those two have inverse correlations, right? If I were to say I have a gamma of 2, you don't know if that means I am twice as bright as I should be in the middle, or it means I need to make things twice as bright because I'm half as bright as I should be in the middle. So gamma is an awkward term. You usually don't know what it means. It used to be screens were very bad at gamma. They're getting better over the years, but it is likely that your computer has some gamma incorrectness for various reasons. And sometimes, when you're playing video games of the dark and spooky character, you want to change your gamma because everything is going to be down here. And you want to like boost that up so you can see it. So it's a little, anyway. So people sometimes intentionally change their gamma to change the effect or to change the feel of what's going on, or because they expect things to be given a different light or so on. There's lots of reasons why gamma exists. It is probably less important now than it used to be, but it's still widely talked about in the various literature and so on. So we needed to talk about it together. Questions about gamma? Yeah.
So would a gamma greater than 1 make the darker regions lighter?
Depending on what you mean by it. So this is the awkward thing, is we use the word in both directions.
Yeah.
If I am measuring the gamma of my screen response, then a greater than 1 gamma is brighter in the grays. If I'm measuring my screen's gamma correction, then a gamma greater than 1 is darker in the grays. And it is so not worth trying to remember this. Just, if it's not 1, it means it's off. And usually you can tell which one it is by saying, does it look dark or does it look light?
Would someone, okay, yeah.
Right, like we will just say, oh, my screen's gamma is 1.7. You're like, right, yeah.
So the reason why this matters is more like human limitation.
So this is originally added because of a combination of human limitation and space limitation. I'm going to store a few colors and still have it respond nicely to humans. There's no reason it needs to exist, right? We have enough space now to make the colors be the colors we want them to be. Other questions about this? All right. So. Fifth, 13 minutes. What are we going to meaningfully do in 13 minutes? Let's talk about how we really store color. We don't have to do color this way. Let me start with that. But almost all illuminated displays, projectors, computer monitors, etc., almost all of these will use the same basic format for color. And that format is going to be a 32-bit integer. Okay? Which, hopefully, you're all somewhat familiar with this concept. But we don't treat it as a 32-bit integer. We treat it as 4 individual 8-byte values. 8-bit values, rather. An 8-bit value can hold a number between 0 and 255. And so we will typically, in some order with green in the middle, but which ones on the other, which of red or blues on the other side will vary. We will store red, green, and blue. Or maybe we will store it with blue on the other side and red on the other side. But that leaves an empty bucket. What do we do with the empty bucket? Sometimes we literally leave it empty. Actually, quite a lot. And this has to do with the way memory hierarchies are optimized for 4-byte aligned reads, right? Yeah. Okay, But sometimes you say, well, we've got it anyway, we might as well put something there. And the most common name for this is alpha. Now, the alpha channel could mean anything. It's just sort of like extra data that isn't color. But overall, if somebody just talks about alpha, what they usually mean is this measures opacity. A 255 means I want to see it. A 0 means it's completely transparent. Don't show it to me. Okay? Now, you don't almost know displays can actually be either transparent or not. Okay? It's very rare to have that ability. Even though if you think about how LCDs actually build, they're based on transparency, but with something glowing behind them because they never get very transparent. Anyway, so we have this transparency channel. This, if we have it, has no bearing on a final rendered image. It is only for stacking things that becomes valuable. So for example, if I take my presentation and say I want it to have a 50% opacity, I change the alpha of my window to 1/2. And I can halfway see the things behind and halfway not. And I can play around with it. I can make it completely transparent. I can make it various kinds of opaque at different levels of opacity. Okay. And so I can play around with the background opacity to change what my screen looks like. But it only matters if there's something behind it. Okay? So on the screen, what is the alpha? It is 1. Because the screen is an opaque piece of thing. Okay? I can't change the screen's opacity. But I can change the opacity of my theoretic layers inside. We actually sort of saw about opacity earlier when we were talking about drawing halftone lines. Okay? When we talk, for example, about how we might draw a line with this filled all the way in and these only half filled in to try to suggest some sort of we're moving gradually between them. We didn't really mean half filled in, really meant all the way filled in, but half transparent. Okay? We aren't saying these should be different colors. We're saying they should somewhat let through whatever was behind. And so if we were to try to say we want just this line by itself, we've made these entirely black, not gray, but with a half opacity, a 50% alpha, 127 alpha, something like that. Okay? That, however, is only an intermediate representation. It's a valuable intermediate representation. It lets things like your window manager decide how other things show on top and behind. But it's just a representation, and eventually we have to flatten that down. Eventually we have to decide how to compose the different pieces. And we've actually already seen different ways to compose. It's not obvious how this should work. So if we think back, actually let me see if I can get back to where we were talking about light. This is one way. I could say if I have a yellow layer and a magenta layer, I should combine them like pigment. And I could use the alpha to say how much light they could absorb, but I should also just make them each do their own individual wavelengths. Okay? I could do that. I could simulate pigments with my alpha. I could also simulate light. So I could, for example, say, imagine we have red light bulbs and green light bulbs, and blue light bulbs, okay? Which is approximately how our screen works. And then I want you to sort of add them all together. And the alpha just sort of tells me how bright the red light bulb is. But I just add them all together. Or I could try to imagine that I had printed this out on some sort of transparency and put it on top of another transparency. Okay? Lots of different ways of composing alpha. Not a single obvious best choice. The most common is called the over operator, and we'll get to talk about this a little bit later. I had it on the schedule later, but we had enough time to talk about it now, so I threw in the basis of it now. So let me point out what I mean. Oh, where do I have alpha? Oh, it may not be for a while. Right, I had it down here, 2 weeks from today. But there's a whole article about alpha. And they describe, like, what does it mean to put things on top of other things and all different kinds of ways you can do it, you know, opacities and overlapping and so on. And then they talk about what different operations would do to different kinds of colors and so on. It goes on at some length. We'll talk probably a little bit more about this math, although not a huge amount more. But whatever we're putting here is typically doing something like that. In recent times, we've started seeing a different use for this, because we started seeing what we call HDR, which stands for a high dynamic range. This is an old technology, but only recently starting to become popular. And what this means is I'm going to store in my image colors that are too bright to show on the screen. So I'm not just going to store colors that I can actually show, capped to the visible range of the screen. I'm going to show other things. If we think about it, the brightest my screen can go is a lot dimmer than the brightest thing in the world. And if I can represent the sun's brightness, then everything else looks black. Okay? So the real world has dramatically different levels of light. So the idea of HDR images is I want to be able to represent that. Again, it's a temporary thing. Eventually, it has to show up on the screen. If I store very, very bright somewhere and not quite so bright other places, there's a chance for me after the fact to combine those in different ways, to add a little bit of lens flare or other phenomena like that, which we'll talk a little bit about later. So often there's different ways this can be done, but often what I will do is I will store red, green, and blue, and then I'll store sort of the overall brightness, or sort of an exponent, if you will. Okay? And so what I'm going to do, if I have, for example, 255, 127, 0, that tells me I have an orange. You can tell I've done this a while if I can write numbers and just know what their valid color is. Anyway, right? So we have an orange. And then if I were to say this is a 7, I would say that's sort of like a 2 to the 7th brightness. Okay? Or maybe it's actually often less than a 2. It's often the square root of 2 to the 7th. Anyway, that's a side note. Anyway, we'll pick some way of just sort of offsetting the whole thing so we can easily talk about, at the level of detail we can tell colors apart, we can talk about the color. And at the level of detail that light actually exists, we can talk about the overall brightness. It's similar to the idea of a floating point number, okay? Except we're sort of sharing the exponent for each of the channels. Color file systems that allow you to store this kind of information and programs allow you to deal with it are increasingly common. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. But we could use this extra byte for anything we want. Now, you might think memory is cheap. Why are we caring about this? So let's just pause for a moment and do a brief computation about pixel space. Okay, my screen that I am using right now, well, it's currently at a lower resolution. So let's talk about its lower resolution right now. It is 1920 by 1080 pixels. Okay, what is 1920 times 1080? Yeah, it's about 2 million. Okay? And it has a pixel in each of those spots, so times 4 bytes, which means that just one picture that fills my screen is in the neighborhood of 16 megabytes. Okay? Now let's suppose I want to play a movie at full resolution. Okay? That would be so if we think about, for example, a 1080p movie, which has this resolution, okay? Let's suppose it's 30 frames per second, and let's suppose, I don't know, it's 1 minute long, okay? So I've got 16 megabytes times 30 times 60. 30 times 60 is? 18. Almost 2,000. So I'm in the neighborhood of, right, 2 times 16 is 32 gigabytes per minute of movie. Okay? Now, how many hours of 1080p movie can I actually get in 32 gigabytes? Way more than that, because we compress it. And we'll talk some about file formats in days to come. but I have to compute it as a graphics, a computer graphics. I don't compute it in its final compressed format. So if I want to render, instead of a 1 minute movie, if I want to render, I don't know, how about a 100 minute movie, a sort of a short end of the feature length movie space, then I need only 3 terabytes just to store the pixels. Okay? If I decided, you know what, it'd be so much easier if instead of each pixel being 4 bytes, I stored it as 4 doubles. Okay? Then that is to say, all right, a double, the most common floating point number we use is 8 bytes long. That's an 8-fold increase. So instead of 3 terabytes, I'm going to need 8 times 3 terabytes, 24 terabytes. Okay? And so on. So although we may think memory is cheap and disks are cheap and so on, I'm already to the point, just to render the frames of one movie, probably to more space than any of you own. Maybe some of you have a 24 terabyte hard drive, maybe, right? Unlikely. And then if I really want to do it for the movies, then I'm not doing it at this resolution. I'm typically doing it at 4 times in each direction. Okay, so then I'm not talking about a 24 terabyte movie, I'm talking about times 16, right? Which we're very quickly getting into silly numbers, okay? Graphics can consume as much space as we can give it, so we will always care about space. Now for this class, I don't want you to crash my servers when I'm testing your code. So you write these tiny little images, right? And that's fine, right? But these are things we'll have to think about. All right, that's the time we have for today. I will see you all on Thursday.